Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And we had a good episode, I think our last episode, with our email. I enjoy reading those emails. We've also got an email that I don't actually have to read an answer, Chuck. We got a listener asking if we could also post our videos on Rumble. And I didn't even, like, honestly, I kind of like given it.
What's a Rumble?
Okay, so Rumble is,
I don't know.
Rumble is like YouTube without the censorship.
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah. So I kind of thought it was a no-brainer. So we may not go into our back catalog, or who knows, maybe I'll try and do them one at a time. But we'll definitely start posting these episodes on Rumble. So people can find us there. And we got some feedback even from people that were like, no, Chuck's not wrong. That's some fucked up shit.
Right. My favorite one was that the dude who said he gave him, he's like, this is my second chance. And he came out and was like, hey, you're not wrong. He's like, I get it. If people don't want to give me a second chance, you're not wrong for wanting to protect your family. Good on you. And I was like, you know what? That means a lot.
Yeah.
So I appreciate it, sir.
We've gotten some good responses. And then the email from the guy named Jody, who acknowledged that he knows what his name means.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was funny. He said he tried to do it. And I feel terrible when I hear people that go out, like my grandfather, when he went out for World War to serve in World War II, and they're like, nope, your eyes are fucked. You're out. You can't serve. You know, my niece's boyfriend got DQ'd from the Coast Guard because of a heart problem, you know, shit like that. So I feel bad when I hear stuff like that, because I know people that have a heart for service and then can't do it. So anyway, but we have our guest for this week's episode is Scott. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, thanks for being here. And
yeah, thank you for being here.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know Chuck gave me a little bit of your backstory, but you are a veteran, correct?
Correct. Yes. I served for about 6 years in the Connecticut Army National Guard. And during that time, I did a deployment to Afghanistan, 2010. So I got out shortly after that, 2011, and, had a pretty rough time over there in Afghanistan, when we deployed. I'm sure we'll kind of get into all of that.
I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And since returning, I struggle with a lot of the things that a lot of other guys are struggling with, you know, PTSD and all that kind of stuff. And, I found a way to kind of cope with that and also help other people at the same time. And it kind of gave me a new sense of purpose and meaning, behind everything that I'm doing, through the podcast that I have, and everything that I do is really kind of geared around like just helping other people through that. So,
what's your podcast?
It's a Drive On podcast.
Right.
And
I see the hat and I know what it's called. I just want to make sure you didn't forget to say it for the listeners.
Yeah, no, I did. I slipped up on that. I should have said it, but, one of the things that we talk about on there is just, you know, the inspirational stories that other people might have and just trying to give hope to other people who might be listening to the show, so that they don't give up on themselves you know, there's really no reason to be giving up on ourselves. And we have too many people in our military community giving up on themselves day after day. And
right.
it just saddens me to see all that happening, you know?
Absolutely.
Especially because that's why we got into this line of work or this calling, is to help people. And so
right.
to then feel powerless. It's like when your wife's like, I'm just venting, I don't want you to fix it. I'm like, damn it, I hate it when she says that, because really, I just want to fix it. I don't want to talk about it.
Right.
We're all fixers. We've all gotten to this line yeah. of work to want to be able to fix things. And now we actually have a chance to affect and create change and within our communities. And then it's a great idea. It's a good
but we
job.
Always, yeah. And we always start out with, how did you end up in law enforcement, firefighting, the military? We would try to get that, because it's always interesting, the shared experiences, but also the differences that get people into it. So why don't you tell us how you ended up in the military, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I was raised in a very patriotic family. I remember when I was a little kid, we went to go greet the troops coming back from Desert Storm, and you know, yeah, and stuff like that. And those were like the superheroes in my world. Like I didn't care about the you know Superman or anything like that. I was looking at the soldiers, and I'd watch like TV shows that had, you know, soldiers in it, and I was like, those are the cool guys, you know.
G.I. Joe, dog.
Yeah, really. Yeah, exactly. But so after 9/11 happened, I was in college at the time, and I was just beyond pissed at the situation. But I decided to stay in college, get my degree. And then a few years after I got out of college, I heard on the news a report that the Army was having trouble meeting the recruiting numbers, and that pissed me off. And I was like, what happened to all those people on September 12th or whatever, you know, who right. were out like ready to go kick some ass?
Right.
And like,
we always said, never forget. It seems some of you have forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't really that long of a time period, you know.
Right. That was
2001
and 2009. Yeah.
Well, this, when I joined, it was like 2005. So,
oh, geez.
I was like, shit, like, how are you people forgetting? And then I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like, well, I'm kind of those people too. Like, I didn't join yet, and so why the hell shouldn't I join? And so I did. And this was after my brother had already joined, my younger brother had joined, and you know, I give him a lot of credit for joining and you know, kind of blazing that trail, and it opened up the door of possibilities to me. And I was like, you know what, if my little brother can do it, I think I could probably do it too, you know?
Right.
So, so we both, he joined in like 2004, I joined in 2005, and, you know, and then we served for, you know, for a while after that. And, but yeah, that, I mean, really it was 9/11 that was a driving force. You know, I don't know that I would have necessarily joined if it wasn't for 9/11. But you know, it was one of those things that, you know, as a growing up in a patriotic family, we're like, you know what, our country needs us, so let's right. do something about it. And so we just jumped in, and we didn't really ask questions. And you know, someone asked me like, oh, you know, you didn't get paid all that much. I was like, I didn't even care if I did get paid. Like, it right. was just, it was like something we needed to do, and so we did it, you know.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And that's why we call it a calling. That's why I don't, that's yeah. not, you know,
you see something that's funny, and it's you looked at the soldiers and the military service members as your heroes. And I it takes me back to when I was growing up, and I used to have a Marine Recon poster on my wall. You know, most kids had like all their Superman stuff. I mean, my son has like, you know, Captain America, Iron Man, all that cool stuff. And I had Marine Recon posters of the dude coming out of the water and, you know, his boonie hat covered in his camo paint and coming up yep. out of the water with his yep. you know, M16. And then, you know, 9/11 happened, and sure, you know, I ended up going into you know, the Marine Corps in 2007. But before that, after that happened, I remember that I was scared going into it. And I was like, whoa, what happened? This happened. I was thinking like we were going to war and they were coming to the United States to attack us. Mm-hmm. And I ended up joining, my dad was a police officer, and I ended up, you know, joining the young Marines because I felt a sense of duty then. And then it transpired into going into the Marine Corps there later on after I graduated high school. But
right.
you know, I think it's great that you had the same line of thought that I had. You know, those were our heroes growing up, were all the military members, not the Marvel comics and stuff.
Right.
Oh no, I remember being a kid, my mother would, you know, we did take me out, would be at, you know, like when you're at mom's for the weekend or whatever, and she's taking you out shopping, and like, I would be like, I want that, you know? And she looked over what I was pointing at, and it was a freaking fighter pilot helmet in a surplus store from Vietnam. Right. She's like, right. Why do you want a fighter pilot helmet? I'm like, because it's awesome, done,
bro.
Yeah. Right. And I had like a special forces flag hanging in my room, you know, and all that stuff. And it, you know, that, like I said, I got mad. G.I. Joe, I'm like, they don't use lasers. They use bullets. G.I. Joe should use bullets, you know?
Right.
So that's how we grew up. And it was something we were called to do is to help people. And I, you know, did police work. Chuck was in the Marine Corps. Now a police officer, you were in the Army, you know, it's that need to make a difference, you know?
It is. Yeah. And, you know, when I looked at those news reports that were saying that the Army wasn't meeting their recruiting numbers, I looked at myself and I did like a, you know, deep reflection. I was like, why not me? You know, I'm young, I'm fit, I'm capable of doing this. So why not? You know, and I really couldn't come up with any really good reasons why I shouldn't serve my country. And, you know, I could come up with some cop out excuses, and yeah, you know, right. But that wasn't going to fly, you know.
Right.
Yeah, because you know they're cop outs too.
Yeah, well, right, because I knew they were cop outs, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's I mean, hard to lie to yourself. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. I knew what I was thinking.
So when you joined up, what did you end up? What was your specialty? What was your job?
I was infantry. I would.
Okay.
So my brother was infantry, and there was no way I was going to do something like finance or whatever. Nothing against the people who did that, but there was no way he was going to let me live that down if I didn't do something like infantry. So
I did that. Is that the same reason you went enlisted instead of officer route?
So I went, yeah. So I could have gone officer route. But the reason why I didn't was because, you know, so I said before, my brother had enlisted before I did, and I respected the hell out of his decision. And I knew that being an officer would be, you know, higher ranking than him. And I never wanted to have my service overshadow his because of, you know, my rank or anything like that. And the entire time we were in the military, we never outranked each other. Like we got promoted like within a month or so of each other, you know, as we were awesome. going along. So so I never wanted to
you're a nicer outrank brother him. Than
me. You know, and if he ended up going like the officer route later on in his career, I probably would have done the same, and it would have been like, well, no, screw that. If you're gonna do it, I'm gonna do it. So
right.
That's awesome.
Well, if you guys are tight like that, I could totally understand why. I would really just look at my brother and just be like, no, you need me to be in charge. I you need me to kind of order you around a little bit. There's right. no world where we should be the same rank. That's because I'm a jerk.
Yeah. Well, so. I could have been a jerk about it, and I suppose
I know.
Looking back, I could have, but I chose. No,
you and your brother were tight like that, man. That's cool. Yeah. Especially, you know, being able to promote through the ranks, you know, every step of the way to kind of, it's a healthy competition instead of an unhealthy one. It's you guys push right. each other to achieve, right?
Or right, exactly.
So
yeah.
So then you get to you go infantry, and you how soon, you said you joined in 05 and then you deployed it like 5 years later in 2010.
In 2010, yeah. So we were it was late 2009, like kind of like November time period when we started like our pre-deployment training and all the paperwork and all that crap that you have to do beforehand. And and then early 2010, we were in Afghanistan. And so my brother's unit, he was in the Vermont Army National Guard, and I was in the Connecticut Army National Guard. His unit and my unit both fell under the same brigade, and the whole brigade was being deployed to Afghanistan at that time. So he and I both went over at the same time. We weren't in the same location because we had different units and we had different areas that we operated in. But, you know, we both were over there at the same time, which I can only imagine was super stressful for my parents and, you know, right. other family and stuff like that, you know, because, you know, having one family member going overseas is pretty stressful. Then having two brothers going over at the same time is right. very stressful. You know, and I know
they make movies about that stuff.
Yeah, no shit, they do. And I do know that kidding. That there is a misconception out there where people think, oh, well, I didn't think brothers could serve together overseas and whatever. And that's
right.
Not true.
But it's not in the same unit or on the same ship, right? That's the...
Well, we had... I don't know about, like, as far as the Navy goes, I don't know about the same ship, but like my company did have several sets of brothers on the same base in the same company.
Okay. Yeah,
so we did deploy together, and I think it's like an unwritten rule, but I think commanders generally will not send two brothers out on the same mission. So okay. if shit went sideways on a mission, then they can, not be losing both of them at the same time.
I wonder if that was something that during the draft that they had for people who were trying to, not go. And mm-hmm. so they were saying, well, I'm the last, if something was to happen, I'm the last brother and the last heir to my line.
Maybe. So I don't know.
It's so you guys, if you've seen anybody who's seen Saving Private Ryan knows that the whole premise is Private Ryan gets a free pass to go home because his brothers are killed. Right.
Right.
And that's the Sullivan rule. Like there are military regulations about, who gets to go home and when and all that kind of stuff.
That movie is a little bit of an exaggeration.
Yes, to some extent. Would never have happened. It's a lot of bit of an exaggeration. Yeah. They're never going to take an entire unit of Rangers to send them after a private.
Well, but even as far as like how they decided, like, no, this guy has to come home. So just from my story, and I read about this in the book Surviving Son, mm-hmm. Where the title of the book comes from is there's an army regulation called Surviving Sons and Daughters. And right. it basically is a provision for people who are in my situation where, and this is going to be a spoiler alert because we haven't even mentioned it yet, but where one of the siblings dies in combat, the surviving son, in this case, me, could apply for an early discharge to get out of
the
military. And so that was on me to do. No one came to me and said, boom, you're out because your brother died. It was just one of those, you have to put in the paperwork for that type of discharge. Now,
makes sense.
As far as when I was in Afghanistan, they did send me home like right away. So it was similar in that regard.
Yeah.
But
and I don't think
was in the military.
Well, and that's the thing. They don't say whether he's being discharged. They just say they're sending him home, and that there's a distinction obviously there. But yes, those rules are in place. I don't specifically know what they are. That's what I had always heard was not the same unit, not the same ship. But clearly you said you've got people that you served with that were brothers in the same company. So, mm-hmm. A gentleman's agreement that the leadership won't send two brothers out on the same mission. It makes sense. Similar to how the Navy's like, we don't put brothers on the same ship. If we have Navy listeners out there that have a correction and know the Navy's policy about, brothers serving on a ship, we'd love to have the answer. That'd be great. Or maybe Matt knows. We'll just ask Matt. He's not here.
Yeah, he might know. Ask him.
But so you serve, you're over there. We've, I think, gotten to the point where it's your floor is yours, man. What's your story?
Yeah. So, we were over there doing our thing for a few months and, things were going pretty well in our area. We didn't have a whole lot of, combat related things. We didn't get into too many like firefights or anything like that. We had, a few attacks on the FOB, like little things that were kind of quelled pretty quickly. But our mission, we were stationed at a forward operating base on the right on the Pakistan border. We were about 2 miles away from the Pakistan border, and where we were was an area called Torkum, and that was like the main supply route for all of NATO supplies coming into Afghanistan, because most of it gets shipped on cargo ships and the closest port to there is in Pakistan. And so they drive them on trucks through there. So we had to basically secure that entryway to make sure that all the cargo trucks had safe passage going through. And that was basically our mission for most of the time that we were there. We did other, missions going out into other areas and stuff, but our main mission was securing that area. And then later on in that summer, we got called on to go on to some other missions that were in further out, more remote areas where we actually had to fly out on helicopters to get to these areas. And so most of the month of August of 2010, my company was out doing these missions, and we're working alongside the Afghan National Army, and we were training them on basically how to do the job that we were there to do. And I like to describe it as kind of like a driver's ed instructor, where we were the driver's ed instructor who has like that extra brake pedal on the right, passenger exactly. side, you know, and
training wheels.
You know, so we're kind of like training wheels. Yeah. And we're there just in case shit went sideways when they were, you know, doing the missions, clearing buildings and all that kind of stuff. And they went through and it was a complete shit show dealing with the Afghan army. It was like, and it also was during the month of Ramadan, which for anyone who's not familiar with that is the Muslim holiday. And during daylight hours, they are fasting, no eating, no drinking, right. nothing like that. And oh yeah, by the way, it's Afghanistan. So it's like 120 plus degrees outside. And so when we're trying to train them and we're outside, the last thing they want to do is move any extra than they have to, because they haven't eaten anything since the night before and or drank anything. So they're like completely spent.
It's basically like one meal a day, right? It's like they're allowed to have like dinner after sundown, but they eat, you know, as much as they can, knowing they're going to go to sleep and wake up and have to do it all over again.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a big feast. And so like we were like, well, let's wait until nighttime when, you know, they get a chance to eat and drink something, and then we can go do that. But like, that's their only time to eat and drink. So they're like partying and celebrating the whole night.
Right.
And they're not up for training at that point. Plus they didn't have like the night vision goggles that we had or anything like that. So it would have been a pain in the ass to try to do that. So
Screw it. I would have been really funny to see the Afghans walking around in the dark, just bumping into stuff because they're tired and they have no night vision.
Well, I mean, I think it would be funny seeing them walking around with night vision, because just seeing them walking around in the daylight and seeing how much they were tripping over their own feet.
Right.
Watching them trying to figure out how to use night vision would be even more funny, I think. But yeah, so I mean, we went on several missions with them. We flew out to remote villages where suspected Taliban activity was going on, and we went door to door clearing the houses. And you know, it was, you know, some of the missions were big nothing, like we didn't find anything. Right. Like our intel was bad, and we got there and it was just like people, like regular people, farmers, right. and whatever. So it was big nothing. But you know, other times we'd get to a village and we'd find like stolen Afghan army uniforms, we'd find weapons and things like that, and we had EOD guys on hand that would blow up stuff that we right. found and just
get rid of. Because most of the time it's a snipe hunt, but occasionally you find something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, quite honestly, looking back on it, you know, we could have been going through some of these villages and, you know, the Afghan army guys that we were with could have just glossed over something because they weren't really looking all that hard for something, right. whether it's intentional right. or not. You know, it could have just been that they sucked at looking for stuff, or they were in on it and they just chose to ignore something.
Yeah. You know, every cop that handed me a prisoner, I searched the prisoner before I put him in my car. No offense to the cop.
Oh yeah.
I just search everybody.
Everybody. Yeah, cause you never know, you know, that's one of those, exactly. you know, if you let your guard down and, you know, then it's, that's on you. I mean,
and if you think this is new, it's not. Insurgent warfare like this goes, like you go back to Vietnam. I remember talking to a Vietnam vet when I was growing up, and he says, yeah, we had a sniper and we were taking fire in this friendly village. And, you know, we finally found the sniper, and one of our guys, you know, nailed him. And we went up there and got his body, and we'd shot him right through his friendly card. And if you don't know what a friendly card is, in Vietnam, they gave friendly Vietnamese people that were supposed to be on the American side a card that proved, hey, I'm on your side. And so he was shot right through his friendly card. So
I don't doubt that at all.
Plan to kill everyone you meet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you definitely do. And sometimes we'd be looking at some of the Afghan guys in the army and like, you know, I'm not so sure about this guy, you know, like is he gonna turn around and start shooting us, or you know, what's the deal? So, you know, fortunately we didn't have any of those situations where they turned on us. So that was good. But
that's good.
You know, where the my story kind of gets interesting, and I talk about this in the book that I wrote, Surviving Sun, is you know, the August 22nd, towards the end of August of 2010, I'm out on a mission, and we're doing the same thing that we would do every other time. We'd go down, you know, we'd fly in late at night in these helicopters. We'd land on top of a mountain outside of a village, and then at first light, we'd walk down into the village and go start clearing these houses. Again, the only reason why we waited till first light was because the Afghan army didn't have night vision and they couldn't operate during nighttime hours. So, we'd go down during the day and kind of clear the buildings and try to look for any enemy activity that's going on over there. And while I'm down in the village searching for stuff, I get a call on the radio from the commanding officer. And at the time I was a E5 sergeant. And if anyone who knows anything about the chain of command, they know that the commanding officer usually goes through the chain of command. They don't just skip over it and go straight to, you know, whoever they're looking for. Right. Yeah. So when I figure out that he's looking for me, I'm like, shit, what did I do wrong? Because it had to be something wrong. Like I didn't do anything
never good.
Extraordinarily good that day. You know, like I'm not getting a Medal of Honor for anything I did. You know what right. I mean? Like I there's no doubts about that in my head. So, I'm like, okay, what did I screw up? And so I start checking all my guys, checking all their equipment, make sure they didn't lose something or whatever. There's something had to be wrong. I couldn't find it. I couldn't figure out what it was. So eventually I link up with him and he's like, you know, come on over here. It was this kind of like secluded area. It was like off away from the rest of the people that we were with, which I thought was a little weird. And he's like, you know, take your helmet off and take a knee. And I was like, I mean, no one ever tells you to take your helmet off,
right.
Especially outside right. the wire. Like, you know, that's just weird.
Now it's setting in that this is
like this, uh-oh. Something's real, like something right. bad is happening here. And so I do what he says. I take a knee and take off my helmet and everything. And so I'm over there and he's like, your brother was, his unit was ambushed and he got hit. And so I jump into big brother mode and I'm like, okay, how do I logistics start going through my head? How do I get to him? Does he need blood? Does he need an organ? Like, what does he need? Right. If I have it, I'll give right. it to him, you know, but let's get me to him.
Right.
And then the commanding officer is like, no, I don't think you understand what I'm saying. He was killed. And I was like, shit. Like I just broke down and I was a mess. I was a complete mess. Like anyone would be, I think, at getting that kind of unexpected news, because when we went over there, that was not even a possibility in my head that either one of us would get injured or killed. And I think that's one of those like defense mechanism kind of things that I did, because had I had that thought in my head that he could get killed, I wouldn't be able to do my job. I'd be figuring out ways to protect him. And I had to just put that possibility out of my head. And so it was like this huge shock when he told me, and it was like this thing that wasn't even a possibility 2 minutes ago is now all of a sudden very real. And it's hitting me like a ton of bricks.
Right.
And I'm just a mess. I'm completely a mess. And, you know, they had, you know, a couple soldiers come over and like hang out with me just to make sure. I think they put me on like a suicide watch, whether I knew it or not.
Whether you needed it or not. Yeah.
Yeah. Whether right. I needed it or not, there was always someone with me. Right. You know, I wasn't suicidal at all during that process, but, you know, it was good that there were people policy, there, you know,
law enforcement, you get in a critical yeah. incident that you get a babysitter, man.
Yeah, they give yeah. you a battle buddy for sure for quite some time.
Yeah. So we're hanging out there for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so. And then we start taking fire from the village we just came out of. And clearly the Afghan army who was searching those buildings missed a whole lot of shit, because there were RPGs and AK-47 fire going off all around us. And ooh. I'm like, shit. I got to put aside this, my personal issues, this grieving process that I literally just started 20 minutes ago. Right. I got to put that aside and jump back into army mode and like go be a soldier and direct my guys, tell them what to do, and try not to get killed myself, and try not to lose any of my guys either, because that would be absolutely devastating, you know, losing one of my guys because I didn't have my head on right, you know? And so the grief that I felt for those 20 minutes turned to like straight anger and hatred for literally every Afghan person who ever was in that country. Like I was so angry at them for not being able to take care of their own shit that it required people like my brother to come there and die. And that to me was just like I hated even the people who I liked, you know, just like an hour before that, you know, that the interpreters and stuff like that, that we had who I had become friends with. I hated them. I was like, why didn't you fucking go kill these people and you know, risk yourself, you know? I mean, they were risking themselves, you know.
Now I gotta come over here and deal with this shit and handle your business because you motherfuckers can't figure it out. And now my But there is a very real element, and I'm sure firefighters can attest to it. I know cops can attest to it, and I know veterans can attest to it. There's an element of anger that you get at innocent people who represent the reason that shit required your presence and bad things were happening to you.
It was every single Afghan person. It was those innocent people, the little kids in the village. I hated them. I hated the Afghan army soldiers. There's one Afghan soldier who was like motioning to me that he needed like oil for his weapon because it was jammed and he needed to clean it, like while we're in the middle of a firefight. I was like, if you fucking listened to us when we were training you, we told you to clean your weapon before we go out on a mission. Like, that's just the thing you do. You don't go out with a fucking dirty weapon. And I was like, no, I'm not giving you shit. You sit over there and die.
Just go fucking die. I don't care. Right.
I don't give a shit about that guy at that point. I was just so angry at everything. But at the same time, I was like, you know what? I need to keep my shit together and not do something crazy, like go charge the village or some shit, you know, where I would end up getting killed. Because the last thing I want is for my parents to get a second knock on the door that day, or, you know, to have any of my guys get injured or killed because I couldn't keep my shit together. And, you know, that was like the most difficult day I've ever had, like ever, because it was just a big shit sandwich handed to me. And it was awful, you know.
Well, if you were to tell me that you had a worse day than that, I'm not sure I'd be ready to hear about it, because that's a pretty fucked up day.
Yeah. And that was all within, like, you know, very short period of time. Yeah, exactly. Less than an hour of each other, you know. And so after the firefight quelled down, after we kind of stopped everything, they called in a helicopter and got me out of there, off that battlefield. They took me to Bagram Air Base, which was also the base where my brother's body was taken, after he was killed. And the other soldier who was killed alongside him, was taken there too. So there were two soldiers that were killed that day. You know, so I was there. They took all of my weapons from me, and they took anything like lethal that I had on me. You know, and again, they never said it, but they were watching me, making sure I didn't hurt myself or do anything crazy. But they insisted that I took a shower because I was ripe after that mission. you know, they, when I was standing there in the shower, and I had one of these, I don't know, I just like leaned my head up against the wall, and I just started yelling out, like, why, Steven? Why? My brother's name is Steven. I was like, why, Steven? Right. Why? And I knew he wasn't like there to answer me or anything like that, but I felt like I was like talking to God. Like, why would you take him? He was 25 years old. Why would you take him? Why not me? I'm older. You know, why not somebody else? Why, you know? And in that moment, I just had like this calming moment in while I was standing there. And it was like, you know what? There's a bigger picture out there that I'm just not supposed to know. And I just have to be, I have to get okay with that real quick. And either I do or I don't. And life is going to continue regardless if I'm okay with it. So I might as well just get okay with it. And I did. And not to say that I was okay that my brother was, you know, killed or anything like that, but it was, you know, I just had to accept it and not really question.
You chose not to wallow.
Situation. Yeah, exactly. So then the next morning, the day after he was killed, the next morning, there was a what's called a ramp ceremony, which for anyone who's unfamiliar with that, it's basically where they bring the fallen soldiers onto the cargo plane that's going to take them out of Afghanistan. And then there's a little ceremony that's similar to like a Catholic wake where you come and pay your respects and things like that. Right. A lot of higher ups, you know, generals and things like that were coming to this thing. And I felt sort of fortunate in that I was able to be there as a family representative for my brother to kind of greet the people who are coming through. I was in like a, you know, kind of a receiving line, if you will. And I was able to greet everyone who came through. And I don't know how I kept it together throughout all of that, but I did somehow, you know, by some stroke of luck. And I managed to get on that same flight out of Afghanistan. I went to Kuwait, with my brother. And from there we had to part ways, and I continued on my journey home, and he did, you know, they did whatever they had to do with him in Kuwait. I think they had some like mortuary affairs kind of people in Kuwait that process the body and all that kind of stuff. But that killed me, having to leave him behind. Like anyone who did even one day of basic training knows you never leave a fallen soldier. And that's what I felt like I was doing. I was just leaving him behind.
Right. And this was your brother that you wouldn't even go to OCS for.
Right. Know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So think about like that kind of connection that we had. Yeah. And I'm like, I would literally have done anything for him. And here I am just saying, oh yeah, go ahead. Random people who I don't know, go ahead and take my dead brother's body and, you know, go do whatever you're going to do with it. And I'm just going to go
back home
and I'll see you all later. And you know, that's it.
Yeah, I'll meet you there.
But you know, in hindsight, it was like, it was really hard for me to do, but in hindsight, it was the right decision to leave him behind, because I think my family needed me home more than my brother needed me to be with him, you know? And so it was a good decision, but you know, eventually
decisions are often hard to see in the moment.
Yeah, it was super hard to see in that moment. It was.
I can see a lot of bad ones in the moment, though.
Yeah, I mean, I could have done a lot of different things there, and somehow I just kept my head on straight. You know, I don't know, but anyways, I make it back home. Like, I think it was like 2 days after he was killed. I'm back home, and you know, so I had like no time to decompress from being in a firefight, you know, in combat and all that. And then losing my brother, I was just.
So how many hours between when you found out and when you were standing in your living room, right? What, less than a day and a half?
Probably. Yeah. Somewhere around 48 hours, you know, with the.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So you went from take a knee to hi mom.
Yeah. Right.
Less than 48 hours.
Yeah.
And somehow managed to find time to get in a firefight and help escort your brother's body halfway home.
Yeah.
So you had a big couple of days there.
Yeah. There's a lot going on those couple of days. Yeah.
That must have seemed like a couple minutes, you know, from when you found out, from when you were standing in your house.
You know, and I'm thinking about the situation now in my head. And I know we've been sitting here talking for a little while, and I know all of that stuff, you know, took place, but it seems to me like it just happened in a blink of an eye.
Yep.
You know, it's just, it all happened so quick.
You probably only remember it in snapshots.
Yeah, I do. But they're very vivid snapshots.
Very vivid. They're like animated GIFs, man. You could see the whole thing moving in your brain, you know, but like what happened in between these little snapshots, people can tell you, and you're like, yeah, don't know. Nope.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Right. Like when you see someone who's like laying out a movie or something like that, they have like the scenes that are like drawn out and like, okay, this is what's happening here. This is what's happening here. I got all those scenes. Like they are good. You know, some of the details in between, maybe I don't quite remember, you know, but I did my best to try to remember all that stuff, because I knew it was important to remember. So, you know, and when I got home, we went straight to my parents' house from the airport. And lining my parents' street were these news vans, like all these television, radio, newspaper, the whole nine yards. And they're all looking for an interview.
Fucking vultures, man.
Yeah. And that's exactly my thought. I was like, fuck these people. I'm not talking to these people. I don't want to deal with these people. Get them out of here. Even when I was in, when I flew into Atlanta, there was all these supporters at the Atlanta airport, you know, greeting the military troops coming home. And I was like, I just put my head down and walked right past them. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I didn't want any, you know, praise or anything like that. I just wanted to go home. But then as I was driving past those news vans, I was like, you know what? They're going to run a story one way or the other. They may get a soundbite from some random dude in a parking lot who's just like, oh yeah, it's terrible, it's a tragedy. And you know, that's all that's going to be played. And it's going to be a 30-second clip and that's it. And so I said, you know what? We need to tell my brother's story and like say who he actually was to these people, because otherwise his, not only did he die, his memory will die. And you know, no one will know who this person is. And so we did it. We did everyone who had a request for an interview, you know, that day and the weeks following, months following, we did all of them. Newspapers, television, radio, and we told his story over and over and over again. And that's what I wanted to do with this book, was tell his story, tell my story, but also, you know, his story, and hopefully help some people along the way too. Because when I came home, I struggled a lot with PTSD, with drinking, with not sleeping enough, the whole, like, it's probably a common story to a lot of people who might be listening to this, you know. And you know, I did a lot of things the wrong way, and I learned from those things, you know. You're and right. And so I really hope that, you know, people who might be struggling could learn something from it, you know. And even if they don't necessarily want to read the book, because that story sounds like a terrible story and they don't want to have to, you know, live through that and read through all of that, you know, maybe their family members can learn something from it and take away something that can help them down the line, you know. So
I remember when I was going through retirement, and Chuck and I have actually discussed having an episode about this coming up, because we've been seeing things about people that have gone through medical retirement, or people that are being forced to retire in the vaccination era. But anyway, my point is that when you go through these things, you know, you don't experience them in a vacuum, but it feels like it.
Right.
And when I actually started opening my mouth and discussing these things with people, I would hear somebody say, oh, me too. Me too. Do you get this? Does this happen? And all of a sudden, you feel a little less crazy.
Right. Yeah. And it helps a lot to know that you're not alone in this stuff. Like whatever you're going through, someone else has probably dealt with it too. You know, whether it's PTSD or depression or anxiety or any, you know, mental health or financial issues or marriage troubles, relationships, you know, trust me, someone else has been there. Like they've dealt with it and they figured something out, you know?
Yeah. I just had this conversation with my daughter. She's 20. She's, you know, she was supposed to start college when COVID happened, and she didn't want to go virtually and waste all that money and all that. So now that, you know, things are settling down, she's able to go back to school. She feels like there's this artificial deadline of having to get things done. And anyway, my bottom line is I ended up talking to her and she fell apart a little bit and she let some emotions out. And I said, don't you feel better? And she's like, yeah, I kind of do. I'm all, see, that's kind of why you're supposed to just talk about these things. It's because just giving voice to it and having somebody say, yeah, I kind of went through something similar and here's how I dealt with it, it has the desired effect of just lifting your spirits just a little bit to keep you out of the very bottom of the dump.
Yeah, exactly. And hearing other people saying the same thing, it gives you that little bit of hope, like, okay, if that person could figure it out, maybe I can too, you know?
Right. You know, Chuck, real quick, I liken it to, and maybe Chuck, you can respond because you've been in both situations, but you know, when you're on a call and you're by yourself as a cop and you've got somebody at gunpoint, or you're about to clear and you, your shoulders tense up because you know, this might be the shit. This might be, you know, you might be in the shit right there. And you hear a trusted partner come up on the radio and advise their ETA is 30 seconds and they're en route to back you up. And your shoulders relax a little bit because you know, in 30 seconds, your battle buddy's going to be there and you got this, right? That feeling. For those of you cops that are afraid to talk about this, or those of you firefighters that are afraid to talk about this, that feeling of release, that little bit of tension release, is exactly what it feels like to finally say some of the shit you're not talking about to somebody who understands.
And oh, yeah, you get absolutely.
This little release.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've been in a few incidents where, you know, it got pretty tense. And then you had more units arriving and you're like, okay, cool. Well, at least I know if I get into, if this goes really bad, I'm going to have a better chance of coming out of this a lot better, at least less unscathed than where I would have been. Or if it does turn to a deadly situation, I have a better chance of surviving because I have more people to the left and to the right of me, you know? Yeah, it's definitely a calming scenario, especially if you like you're in an all-out drug-out fight, you and your partner, and then next thing you know, you hear the sirens because you weren't able to get anything out, but people know you, and then they can hear the brakes on the microphone coming through, and they know, uh-oh, it's going bad, and then a help call gets put out, and the next thing you know, you have people rushing up, and you see their face, and you're like, oh, okay, all right, I'm good, and then they're like, hey, you want to get off, you know, and let me take over. And you're like, absolutely take over.
Yeah.
And then they come and they take over and you sit down and you're like, holy shit, that was wild.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a big calming, a moment of just calm when you were just in this crazy tense, you know, fight or situation, and it's a moment of clarity and you're like, holy shit. Now Scott, after knowing what you've gone through and how tough it was, you said you struggled with, you know, PTSD, drinking, depression, some anxiety, which is all completely normal. But how did you cope with it from then to now, to be where you are now? And I know it's still a struggle because, mm-hmm. you know, it's never going to be easy, but it's more manageable now. And how were you able to get there?
Yeah. So when I first came home, I was, like I said, I was a mess. I was just not myself. And I talk a lot about my struggle and my journey in the book, but you know, eventually I realized that I wasn't getting any better on my own, and you know, all of the things that I was doing were textbook like wrong things, drinking and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I decided to go to the vet center, and I talk to someone there. The vet center, for people who don't know, is associated with the VA, and they provide counseling services to service members and their families and stuff like that. So, so I went there for a couple of years, you know, back and forth talking with the counselor, and it was just, you know, like a therapy session, like almost like what you would expect from, you know, TV shows where the guy's sitting on, you know, in his chair, and I'm sitting over on a couch or whatever. It's not like laying down on a couch or anything like that.
No,
like
but yeah,
stereotypical nice, thing,
but you know, yeah.
It's a comfortable location, and
yep.
It's all, you know, confidential, you know, you're not, you know, they're not out to get you or anything like that. And it was a good place. I had a good person that I was talking to, and we, you know, went back and forth and worked through some issues. And I felt like I was getting better. So I stopped going. And then a couple of years later, I noticed myself slipping back into some of the things that were a problem before. And, you know, one thing that I like to tell people is that, you know, mental health is just like any other physical health, where with your physical health, you go to the doctor for checkups every once in a while. And like, that's not weird to go to the doctor. You go and, right. you know, just, hey, is everything working all right? Yeah. All right, cool. We're good. And yeah. you know, I'll see you next year or whatever.
Yep. Annual physical.
Exactly. You know, that's what it is. And, you know, your mental health, you know, if you just wait until things are a problem, it's going to be a whole lot harder to fix the things that are wrong with you. Yeah. And, you know, so going for even just call it a checkup, going in, you know, every so often to chat with someone just to say, hey, you know, this little thing's kind of bugging me and I, you know, I'm having a little trouble with this. You know, it may not seem like it's really that big of a deal and that you could probably deal with it, but all those little things eventually pile up to one big thing, you know, and, right. and then it, be, then it becomes a problem. And so right. if you can deal with those little things, you know, it's a similar analogy to sweeping stuff under the rug. Yeah. Maybe if you sweep one thing under the rug, you're not going to notice it. But once when you start piling everything under the rug, then you're going to have a carpet.
Eventually you get a log
on, you know, right. exactly. Yeah. yeah. So, yeah. so, you know, it's the same idea, you know, and so I eventually went back to the VA and sought additional counseling and treatments and stuff like that. But, you know, a couple of years ago, I started my podcast, the Drive On podcast, and that's not therapy, but it's almost like therapy because I get to talk to other people and hear other people's stories and it's yep. it's like
we say the same thing probably, on here. I say group therapy is stupid bullshit. I hate group therapy, and I'm saying that perfectly well aware that this podcast does function as a weird form of group therapy for me and everyone else that comes on the damn show.
It is, and I'm not like a mental health counselor. I'm not like a doctor, psychologist, or anything like that. I have no formal training in this or whatsoever, but I've screwed up enough that I think I know, you know, what not to do at least. Well, you know,
so before there were shrinks, people managed, and the way they managed was they had these really neat people to talk to called homies.
Yeah.
Hey, am I fucked up? Yeah. Well, here's what I'm going through. Yeah, you're fucked up, but that's not why. You're cool with that. That's fine. I totally get that. I do the same thing. You know, oh, cool.
Right.
Move on, you know.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So you know, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, like, when I got in my my incident at work, one of the incidents that had a really, really drastic impact on my life and still does to this day. I mean, and I know that it's changed me and I'm still changing and it's still a struggle and I still have issues with it. And sometimes it still affects my home life. But I talked about it on this podcast a long time ago when I came on as a guest before I was a host. And I talked about my incident, but I never talked about what happened afterwards or how I dealt with it. And I got to say, I thank to God that I had some good friends that that kind of helped me through it. And then I thank God that I found my wife, who I just recently married, but I thank God that I found her. And through this whole thing, and we had just started dating, and you know, she really helped me through a lot of shit. And I'm glad that happened. And you know, my work made me go to some counseling, which I thought was fucking stupid. And I did it.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, I should probably keep going.
Yeah.
To be honest, if I'm being quite honest, I probably should. And I'm glad that I'm on this podcast now because I get to talk to other people and hear their stories and it makes me feel less crazy. And
yeah, hearing, I mean,
and hearing crazy. Your story, it resonates with me like a lot.
Well, I mean, I'm glad, I'm not glad that it does, that you had, you know, a situation that would, you know, put you in that need for, you know, counseling or whatever. But, you know, I'm glad that it does resonate with you given the cards that you've been dealt, because, you know, then you, like anyone else who might be struggling with something are like, you know what? Okay, fine. You know, this isn't that big of a deal. I can go talk to somebody. It's, you know, it's not like I'm crazy for
right.
going and getting help, you know? So,
right.
And it's not, you know, it's definitely not crazy to go and get help. You get help for literally everything else that could be wrong with you. If you break an arm or a leg or something like that, you're going to go get a cast on it and you're going to go get it set. And no one's going to be like, oh my God, you're nuts for, you know, going and doing that. Like, why, you know, you're supposed to do that, you know? So well, and why not take care of yourself?
Yeah. And if you don't think this stuff has, you know, an effect on you, like we talked about, this all happened in a matter of a 48 hour period for you. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'll go back and I'll use a real quick example as we're closing out. But my nephew, when he was like 1.5, he had surgery. He had open heart surgery because he had like a hole in his heart or whatever. And it was, you know, no big deal. The doctor was like, yeah, we're going to do open heart surgery on a you know, toddler, but you know, we do it all the time. It's fine. And he came through it and he's good. And he's got a little scar on his chest and stuff like that. He's now like 5, right? So this was 3.5 years ago. I can't remember shit from when I was 18 months old or 2 years old. Right. And I doubt this kid can specifically remember things either, but you know what? Whenever he gets around doctors or hospitals, he gets really agitated. And I realized, you know, right around the 3 or 4, you know, I fell into a fire pit and had to, you know, go to a burn unit and stuff like that. And I still get agitated around hospitals, you know. So those are little things that happen to you when you're still developing the ability to make a memory, right? So you don't have to even consciously remember something for it to stick with you for your entire life. So now you fast forward to being an adult and you have all the baggage you have from being a kid. And then you have something that completely shatters your world in the space of the time it takes to tie your shoe and then try to pick up the pieces afterwards. It's going to affect you, period.
It will. Yeah. I mean, your whole world is different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Everything is different.
You know, everything that I imagined from my life and my family's life, you know, from that point forward was different. You know, my right. brother he was engaged. He was going to get married when he came home and you know, that obviously didn't happen, you know,
and I
had envisioned, you know, when I grew up, we lived near cousins and we would go play with our cousins all the time. And I just assumed that, you know, I would have kids, my brother would have kids and our kids would play together and be best friends, like just the same way that I was with my cousins. And then none of that happened. You know, it's like your whole world just gets turned upside down. And when something like that happens to you, it's going to have an effect on,
yes.
on you mentally and everything. You have to be able to deal with it. And it might require you going to talk to somebody, and it's not a weakness to go talk to somebody.
No. In fact, I would argue it takes more bravery to put yourself out there and say, I need to talk. Anybody can shut the fuck up.
Yeah. That's anybody easy. Doing nothing is easy.
Yeah. Doing nothing and drinking it away is, you know, that's default setting, you know?
Right. Exactly. That's a no brainer. Like you can go and buy beer and, you know, whatever you want to drink, and you can drink it away all you want, and that's easy. It's not the right thing to do, but it's easy. Right. And the right thing to do very rarely is the easy thing to do.
That's why I said I know what the wrong decision is every time I see it. It's really hard to know what the right one is, though.
Right.
We always let our guests, we try to dedicate every episode to a fallen brother or sister. In this case, it sounds like it's literal. So Scott, please, the floor is yours. Dedicate your episode.
Yeah, so I'm going to put this one out there to my brother, Sergeant Stephen DeLuzio, KIA, August 22nd, 2010. And if I can throw in another one, Sergeant Tristan Southworth, who was also killed alongside my brother that day. He was the other soldier who was killed. I want to throw his name out there too, because, you know, he died, you know, trying to help my brother. And that was, I mean, that's a whole nother episode right there. You know, just talking about that situation, what happened, that day for them. It's just completely devastating. So yeah.
Well, if you're up for it, we'd love to have you back on to tell your brother's story to represent. He's not able to represent himself, and we'd be glad to have you come back to represent him.
Yeah, for sure. I would love to.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, rest easy, brothers. We've got it from here. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't let you tell everybody where they can find your book and your podcast, obviously.
Yeah, so the book you can get on Amazon. It's Surviving Son, or you can go to survivingsonbook.com. It has tons of information about the book and social links and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, Amazon's the easiest place to go, Surviving Son. And the podcast, anywhere you listen to podcasts, it's Drive On Podcast or driveonpodcast.com.
Right.
Awesome.
And Chuck, do you have anything?
Yeah. So if you guys are looking to book a slot onto the podcast, go to booking.warstories@gmail.com. Or if you follow us on any of the social platforms such as Facebook or Instagram, click the link in the bio and you can go straight in that link to the booking email, And if you have questions for either Tom or I, you can questions for me, you can go to booking questions for Tom. It's the mailbag one, and it's clearly listed on there. Just click it. And if you don't follow us on one social, but not the other, the link for that other social is in there. And as well right. as the link to the YouTube account is in the link as well in that and, bio. And
we'll have to add the Rumble account, I guess.
I guess we're going to have to add Rumble. Have to. Maybe while we're at it, we'll just do an OnlyFans.
Right. pictures of Chuck and I and grape smugglers.
I'm going to chime in here and say I would pay to not see that. So,
ooh, well, it's $9.99 for a month to not see it.
No, we're gonna make our social media profile public, and we'll post pictures of us in Speedos, and then people have to subscribe to not see it. There we go.
I have an old throwback and some silkies and a crop top. That's amazing. Oh, a fake mustache.
We'll have to do. Pictures of us in our silkies when we get some more.
Dude, ridiculous. You know what? I was going to wait to do a massive drop with a bunch of different pieces of apparel. There's a couple things that we're waiting on, and I don't feel like I want to wait on it any longer. So I think right before I go into surgery this Thursday, I might be releasing all of the apparel that we have. And if it sells out, I'm assuming some of the sizes will probably sell out quick. It's okay. Message me that you're interested. I will go and reorder.
Yeah.
Some of those sizes that do sell out, we have the license for the artwork. So it's just real simple. We go and we throw in another order and we get to you guys right away. So just throw me an email, or message us on the website, which is also in the bio. And we're going to do that. So keep out for social media platform. If you're listening to it here and you don't have social media, go to the website, hopefully Wednesday, if not Thursday, when I get out of surgery, I'll finish it. And you can buy some new gear. We should have some stickers, a special edition sticker, or a t-shirt. You guys are going to get a free gift in the bag as well if you order. And those supplies are limited to the first 100 people who order. So
first 99, because I need to get one.
First 98, because I'm gonna take one.
So and we're gonna do a website rebuild. I've got somebody who wants to do it for us, so I can stop. Absolutely. You can stop staring at my ugly, terrible, if I was any smarter I wouldn't have been a cop version of a website that we have. So anyway, you guys can support us by going on there and getting the merch and stuff like that. We appreciate it. And we got some new locker room stuff coming up for this Wednesday or for the Thursday's podcast. So we'll talk about that. And Chuck will hopefully be available before he goes under the knife, and then we'll have to check in with him when he comes out. So we all hope for the best for Chuck. I just did it, you know, went under the knife. So now it's your turn. We're getting old. It's just
this my second one in like 2 months. I'm so pumped and so stoked that they're going to be throwing in some screws in my leg. Yay.
You bionic man, dude.
Dude, you're fucking horrible.
Just ask him if you can get the, you know, the sound effect when you like move and stuff like that. That'd be cool.
Dude, I'm going to be squeaking like the fucking Tin Man from Wizard of Oz.
Oil can. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting.
Well, all right. Well, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.